Mr. Razas?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Floor is yours. Your Honors, and may it please the court. There's three issues that I want to focus on today of why the summary judgment in this case was improperly granted and it needs to be vacated. The first is related to the statute of limitations, and what I want to focus on particularly is the breach of contract claim. And what was argued in the summary judgment was rejected by the magistrate judge. In addition, this is a very, very, very unique contract. I've never seen something like this before, where you don't have to buy anything and Plymouth didn't have to sell anything. It is more akin to a commission contract, which is why our serial breach argument is important here to show that the breaches that happened after the fact, each one of those are their own independent breaches.
Did you raise this with the magistrate judge?
Your Honor, we objected to the magistrate judge.
Did you argue serial breach, though, before the magistrate judge?
No, Your Honor, because it wasn't raised by by Plymouth, by the appellee here. In terms of what Plymouth raised in the breach of contract argument were two things. One was termination and repudiation. And that was it. And the magistrate judge rejected those arguments. And Plymouth didn't appeal that, didn't object to that. And so we didn't know that the magistrate judge would go beyond that to argue that the statute of limitations barred the entire breach of contract claim. And therefore, we didn't have an opportunity to raise a serial breach argument because we didn't know that that was even going to be important to raise at that time.
But didn't you have an opportunity to object to the magistrate judge's findings, conclusions, and recommendations to address that before the district court?
And we did. We did. We raised that and presented to the district court, which the district court noted that it reviewed de novo. And so the district court went beyond what the magistrate judge had done to do a de novo review. And so that was, it's proper before this court in terms of the serial breach argument. In addition, and I'm happy to continue on with the statute of limitations, but I also want to address the res judicata issue. I've got 3 points there as well that I'd like to address. One is related to the Doherty case, and this is under Illinois law and the purpose of res judicata. Secondly, there's different parties in this case, and the district court erred when it determined in an adjudicative fact that it was subject to reasonable dispute. And that's the only basis that it used to determine that these were the same parties. And then in addition, going into the same claims argument, if we look specifically at what was raised by PowPro Steel LP in the Illinois suit, there are different claims than what were raised by PowPro LLC and Cheap Pile bringing it on behalf of PowPro LLC in this case. And then the last issue is to discuss in terms of the discovery rule. So getting back to the statute of limitations arguments, in terms of the, as we discussed before, the claims that were raised and the arguments that were raised in the summary judgment by Plymouth as to statute of limitations were for the breach of contract, just the termination and repudiation. And then for the fraud, it was based on the 2016 suit in Illinois. But those fraud claims in the 2016 suit in Illinois were based on different arguments, different facts. So the fraud claim originally in the April 2016 filing of the counterclaims by PowPro Steel LP were based on what they claimed to be a misrepresentation in 2014, in June of 2014, that said that Plymouth would continue to manufacture products for PowPro Steel LP in the same quantities and type as what they had historically done. In the July 2016 iteration, it changed it and said that there was fraudulent inducement for the 2011 contract. Those were different claims than what Sheet Pile raised in this suit. Sheet Pile raised in this case that there was fraud based on the 2014-2015, particularly the 2015 statements that Plymouth was not going to get back into the business at all. And in fact, it chastised Sheet Pile for when it chastised PowPro LLC, now Sheet Pile, for making an assertion back in August of 2015 that Plymouth was selling products to Nucor, Skyline, and those type of things, and that was getting back into the business. In fact, it specifically says, and I quote, this is on record 643, Why can PowPro just not accept the fact that we are out of the business of making their products per our mutual agreement for them or anyone else? And it basically said that PowPro was crazy to think that somehow that Plymouth was getting back in the business and was selling some products to Skyline. Now, Plymouth had a history of selling to Skyline before, which is why it was entered into that 2011 contract, that there was allegations of that Plymouth was violating the contract before, and so instead of suing, one of the provisions in that contract says that we're not going to sue each other for prior breaches of this. We're going to enter into this contract. This contract itself, though, said, again, very oddly, Plymouth doesn't have to make any products, and Sheepal doesn't have to buy any products. What has to happen, though, is that if Plymouth does sell products, it's got to sell it to PowPro. That's where this is more like a commission-type contract. Just like in a commission basis, there's no requirement that the salesperson actually sell products, but they don't get paid until they do, and each order, individual order, is what determines the damages. And of course, in Texas law, there's four elements for breach of contract. Got to have a valid contract, performance, breach, and damages. If you don't have damages, there is no contract. And here, this is an order-by-order basis for everything that was done by Plymouth after the fact in terms of any sort of breach. Just like in the contract itself, it says that if PowPro bought products from Plymouth, that would be on an order-by-order basis. And each order would have its own specific requirements and those type of things.
But the first time that Plymouth sold to someone else, they breached the exclusivity provision, correct?
They breached it for that order.
But I mean,
how's
that different than if they continue to sell to someone else other than PowPro?
Well, for example, in what the district court relied on was that lube case from Michigan. As an example, that was a distributorship contract. Okay, and in a distributorship contract, you know that there's products that are going to be made, and generally speaking, they're going to sell a just range of products to the distributor, who then goes and distributes them.
District court also distinguished like installment sale contracts, and that's clearly not what this is.
And I agree with that, Your Honor, but it's not like a distributorship contract, and I agree it's not like an installment contract.
Well, maybe not, but doesn't your argument sort of undermine itself? I mean, in other words, if it's per order, but it's periodic, no interval or anything like that, it seems like the first time they sell to somebody else, that's a breach.
It is, Your Honor, but it's just like with a commission contract. And again, with a commission contract, each commission is considered to be its own breach. When the first failure to pay on a commission at the beginning, that's a breach. But the second failure to pay on the commission is also a breach, and it's a separate breach. And Texas courts have held that separate breach, that second breach, is a standalone breach of that contract, of that commission contract, such that it would start the statute of limitations again. So that's where I'd see the difference in there, is because there wasn't a requirement to buy, because there wasn't a requirement to sell, it is more akin to something like a commission contract where each individual breach forms the basis of a breach of contract action that would start the statute of limitations over. In terms of the res judicata argument, I think that the...
Well, before you leave that argument,
yes, Your Honor.
Back to my initial question, I may have interrupted you too early, and I apologize for that, but your contention is that you raised this before the magistrate judge, or you did not raise it before the magistrate judge?
We did not raise it before the magistrate judge, Your Honor. We didn't believe
we
had
to. In the objections to the magistrate judge report and recommendation?
We did, Your Honor.
The district court said, well, you didn't raise it before the magistrate judge, therefore it's forfeited.
So the...
Right, though, under the law?
Well, the issue was, Your Honor, is that we didn't know we had to raise it before the magistrate judge.
There wasn't an issue. Limitations argument being made before the magistrate judge?
Yes, Your Honor. We didn't waive the issue. Of course, you can waive issues, but you can't waive arguments. We didn't waive the issue. That was raised before the magistrate judge. That was objected to before the magistrate judge.
You didn't raise this ground before the magistrate judge. That's forfeiture, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, it's not, because for one, the district court also addressed it. And so the district court said that wasn't raised before the magistrate judge, but then addressed it on its own.
So it's sort of an even if addressing it.
And I understand that, Your Honor, but again, I don't know how Sheepal could have raised this before the magistrate judge when the only arguments raised by Plymouth were related to repudiation and termination. The magistrate judge denied those, but then went beyond. And so we didn't know that that was even at issue until the magistrate judge rendered its report and recommendations. And that's when we addressed it before the district court, before it got on appeal. In terms of the res judicata argument, and Your Honor, I don't want to, if you have further questions on that.
No, thank you for that. I'll have to go back and square the magistrate report and recommendation with what the district court said in its order.
Yes, Your Honor. Under the res judicata, I'd like to focus a little bit on the Doherty case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, applying Illinois law. Of course, for res judicata, we need to apply Illinois law in this case. I don't think it's much different from Texas law, but it has some jurisprudence related to that. And the key thing for the Doherty case, I think the key thing for res judicata overall is the point of res judicata is to prevent a collateral attack of a prior judgment. And here, just like in the Doherty case and its analysis, there's nothing that happens in this case that could possibly collaterally attack what happened in the 2016 Illinois lawsuit. And so Doherty goes through a series of cases, including from the Illinois Supreme Court. And it said, for example, quote, the Illinois Supreme Court has held that if the basis of dismissal against one party bears no relationship to the merits of the case, it is inappropriate to apply the doctrine of res judicata against another party to that action. Basically, what it was saying for that, as well as it also talked about how the prior dismissal must have caused the defendant to prepare a defense against that cause of action. It's one of the things that was key in that case. Here, there's no evidence that Plymouth ever had to prepare a defense against any breach of contract or fraud action that was here in this case. And so res judicata is inappropriate, just like in that Doherty case. In here, it would not serve the ends of what res judicata is.
So what is your best Illinois case? Is it Doherty or something else that stands for the proposition that Palpro Steel and Palpro LLC were not in privity for res judicata purposes?
Absolutely. So, Your Honor, I would go to actually a Fifth Circuit case on that, which is the Taylor v. Charter Medical Corp case, because the only evidence that they were in privity.
And what state law is that applying?
Your Honor, I think it's, I don't remember what, but it's applying in the Fifth Circuit, but it's citing to the Astron case in the Fifth Circuit cites to a U.S. Supreme Court case talking about to show privity, you need to show control. You need to show that the parties that the Palpro LLC was in control of Palpro Steel LP at that time. And that's the Lawler v. National Screen Service Corporation case. It's 349 U.S. 322. It's cited in the Astron case. And the issue here is the only evidence that was presented, or strike that, the only evidence that was cited to by the district court was taking an adjudicated fact that was in dispute in another suit and then applying it here. And under the Taylor case, looking at Rule 201, that's improper. Because here, it is in reasonable dispute. There's nothing in the record today that says that Palpro Steel LP is anything other than either a subsidiary or affiliate. And it actually doesn't even say which one. And we only get that from the 2011 contract that talks about how this applies to Palpro as well as its subsidiaries or affiliates. That's on record site 665. And so what happened was is the district court has said that there's the same parties here simply because it's taking this fact from another lawsuit that it's not allowed to do. And so therefore, we don't have...
Do you dispute that Palpro Steel LP was the, quote, operational arm of Palpro, the Palpro entities?
We do, Your Honor. We do dispute that.
Where is that in the record?
When you're saying...
Evidence to the contrary of what the district court found here.
Well, Your Honor, there's not evidence either way. The district court simply took something from another case, applied into this case, that wasn't raised below.
Well, are you talking about the Chang case?
Yes, Your Honor.
The reported FedSup third case that the district court cites to.
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely, and I understand that, but under this court's precedent, you cannot take judicial notice of that adjudicative fact unless it is not subject to reasonable dispute. And here, that's one of those facts that absolutely is subject to reasonable dispute. I don't even know exactly what operational arm of PowPro means. That doesn't say that PowPro controls PowPro Steel. It doesn't say that there's really much of anything. But the court took that and said, this is an adjudicative fact. I'm taking judicial notice of it, which it cannot do under this court's precedent.
Did it need to? Doesn't the exclusivity agreement say that it is between Plymouth and, quote, PowPro LLC, together with its subsidiary and affiliates, including but not limited to PowPro Steel LP?
And yes, Your Honor, it does, because the point here is whether or not these parties were in privity in terms of whether or not they were, PowPro LLC would have to control PowPro Steel.
If they're both referenced in this underlying contract?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, because it has to be to show that PowPro Steel, the test is whether or not PowPro Steel is basically sitting in the exact same shoes as PowPro LLC, that it is, that the same same interest, same everything is being represented by PowPro Steel, and you have to have evidence of that showing that there is some sort of control or otherwise under the Astron case, as well as citing to the Lawler v. National Screen Service Corporation from the United States Supreme Court. Last thing I want to, I've got limited time here, but the last thing is in terms of the same claims. So there were not the same claims either in the 2016 suit or the claims here. For breach of contract just on its own, I would say that it talks about the breach being, in quote, subsequent to October 31st, 2011. Here the claim was at least from 2013 after. So we're talking about there's at least separate claims, and Your Honor, I apologize, I'm out of time. If I may finish this, or
sure. No, finish your point.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here there's at least differences in that one, and I've already talked about with the fraud claim, how the fraud claim was separate, and therefore, because the claims are separate on these, then res judicata cannot apply. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Terrazas. We'll see you back on rebuttal in a few minutes. Mr. Carlisle.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Ethan Carlisle. I represent the defendant, Plymouth Tube Corporation, Plymouth Tube Company. It's simple, we believe Judge Ezra's well-reasoned opinion adopting Magistrate Lane's report and recommendation granting summary judgment for my client, Plymouth Tube, in the underlying case was correctly decided and should be affirmed. There were no genuine issues of material fact on the issues that we moved on, and we addressed all of their claims, and there were even multiple arguments on claims. So if there is anything that the court disagrees with, there are avenues to affirming that judgment in full. So I do want to point out at the start, there was some discussion by my friend on the other side about res judicata and fraud. We never moved for res judicata on fraud. We move for res judicata on breach of contract, and that's clear in the underlying documents. So yes, PowPro did sue us in a counterclaim for breach of contract and fraud back in 2016, and now PowPro LLC is suing us for breach of contract and fraud. We are, the fraud allegations between those two proceedings are different, but the breach of contract is not. That's why we only move for res judicata on breach of contract. We move for statute of limitations on both grounds. I think that's all clear in the record. I just wanted to clear that up. Okay, so, you know, I don't know the law, Your Honor, I admit, on the magistrate. You don't do a ground, you don't object to a ground in there, but you object to the whole thing later. You know, I think it's a little dirty pool because we would have duked it out back then if they had brought it up. But
what about counsel's argument they wouldn't have known to raise the serial breach issue?
Yes, so that's it. I hope I don't need that. That's in this outline. All right. It was in our reply, and this is a record on appeal 956. This is our reply in the summary judgment. So this, you know, we moved, they responded, we replied, this is all before the report and recommendations. We said, you know, we did argue that the termination of the agreement could be the start, but we said, if you don't buy that, and I quote, even if the breach is defendant sales of connectors and not the termination of exclusivity rights, plaintiff admits that this lawsuit was filed in November 2020 and was more than 4 years after the alleged breach. So I think it was there. And if they had a problem with that, they could ask to address that with the magistrate at that time. And
that was in your reply brief?
It is in the reply brief.
What did you raise in your primary brief?
In the primary brief, we argued that the termination was the start.
So you didn't argue then that the date of the transaction was
breached? I have to go back and dig in it. I maybe it's in there, but we did say that the termination was the start, and I'm not positive if we also said that sales of connectors was the start as well. But I don't think it matters, and that's why I admitted, let me just grab it. Because the court was correct anyway when it addressed it. Like Your Honor said, this is nothing like an installment contract. It is nothing like a commission agreement, okay? And in the cases that the plaintiff cited for that argument or in the brief, it's Barker Ekman. I call that the Bull Seaman case, and then they have Garden Ridge. So in Barker Ekman, that was a bailment, okay? So in those types of cases, bailments, alimony, installment contracts, during the period, there's a new event or a new triggering something that triggers a payment from the obligor or the obligee to the obligor, right? A new month, you gotta pay a new alimony check, okay? A commission, salesman makes a sale, you gotta pay, right? You got to pay him a commission, or an installment contract, you know, could be like a lease or something where, you know, you're paying on time. That's not the situation here, okay? And in all of those types of cases, there is new conduct, okay? There is something new that happens. Well, I just sold to John, and under our agreement, when I sell to John, you have to pay me, okay? Or an alimony. It's now a new month. When it's a new month, you have to pay me. And here we made one promise, okay, which is as long as this agreement isn't terminated and is in place, we will not sell connectors to other people, okay? And nothing changed. We, you know, it's on the record. They didn't pay us for some connectors. They also didn't pay us for some attorney's fees where they had an obligation to indemnify us. And we said, fine, we're terminating exclusivity. Then we start, we had to deal with that case where they were not defending us. And the settlement in that case, that's the Skyline litigation, was, okay, Skyline, you're suing us. They're not defending us anymore. Uncle, we've terminated. We're gonna start making connectors for you, okay? That's a confidential settlement agreement, right? But that was the circumstances. So now we're banging out connectors for Skyline, okay? Nothing's changed from then until the end of this termination period. It's the same conduct, making exclusivity products for others. And that's why those other cases simply don't apply.
I have a question.
Sure.
So in the April 20th, 2015 letter, when Plymouth alleges bad faith in part for failing to honor the indemnity agreement.
Mm-hmm.
The indemnity agreement was in relation to the litigation with Skyline that later led to Plymouth selling product to Skyline?
Correct. That's absolutely correct. So,
anything in the record that PilePro or SheetPile was aware of that lawsuit and the issues alleged in that lawsuit?
Yeah, they were a party to it. So yes. And then after we settled, it was dismissed, and they received a notice of dismissal. And even the notice of dismissal said the claims against PilePro are continuing. We're just letting Plymouth that. Is that clear?
At issue in that lawsuit was the exclusivity agreement between Pile Pro and Plymouth?
Yeah, it was an anti-competition lawsuit. They were like an antitrust or something. They were saying y'all's agreement that you can only make connectors for them and not other people is unlawful. Okay. So that's breach of contract. I think that's covered. Now let's talk about, we talked about serial breach. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion about discovery rule. I mean, that's on breach of contract and fraud, I think that's a no-brainer, okay? On April 2016, Pile Pro Steel LP sues us and a counterclaim and says, you're making connectors for others, okay? You made connectors for others after the agreement. That's the exact same allegation they're making now. You're making connectors for others. So it's the same claim, and I got lost in my own head. Okay, the claim is the same, the conduct is the same, and there's really nothing different between those two allegations. And if you look at Judge Ezra's opinion and Judge Lane's report and recommendation, they lay out right above each other the two allegations and the two proceedings, and they show that they're the same. And so it's really a no-brainer. And now let's talk about, you asked a question, Justice Willett, about the privity. And there is a lot in the record, and this is the, so let's talk about that. And here's something I just found this morning, but it's in the record, and this court can affirm summary judgment on anything in the record. The letter, August 11, 2014 letter that my client sent to PilePro saying—
What's the record site for that?
I'm sorry about that. It's 641. It's the style of the case, and then it says .641. That letter that Plymouth sent to PilePro saying, hey, we're getting out of the extrusion of carbon steel business. We're not gonna, we'll finish up the orders you've given. We're not gonna make any more. That letter was sent to PilePro Steel LP, okay? Guess what's happening in this lawsuit right here that we're up on appeal about? PilePro LLC is suing us saying this letter, the statements in this letter were fraudulent. How does that not show privity right there? I think that's game, set, match. They're suing us for a statement that we made to their subsidiary and affiliate, who's also the co-signer of the agreement. It shows that their interests are aligned, okay? They're the same interests. And that's really, so the evidence is, you talked about it, identical. They're both parties to that agreement. I think that shows privity. There's been no showing that they have different interests. You asked the question, well, do you dispute the operation arm? Yeah, we do. Is any of that on the record? No. If I'm representing someone and someone says, hey, that judgment back there was res judicata, you can't sue me now. And I go, that wasn't me. That wasn't me because they're different owners, they're different managers. That one does this, I do that. None of that's in the record. We put enough in the record to show privity. It was their burden to say, uh-uh, and that didn't happen. So what is in the record? Same agreement. They both signed the agreement. They have the same obligations to us, PilePro Steel and PilePro LLC. We have the same obligations to them. Identical. There's an identity of interest. They're co-obligors under that agreement. Under Illinois law, co-obligors are in privity. This is also in the record. This is record site 638 through 639. Robert Wendt is the managing member of PilePro LLC. He is also the managing member of F. Sempe LLC, which is the general partner of PilePro Steel LP, okay? He signed an agreement, an indemnity agreement, In those, with the signature block stating that, that shows that they have the same manager, the same guy running both companies. That shows privity. You could also see privity just by looking at the claims, the exact same claims, which shows an identity of interest. You have their subsidiaries and affiliates. Mr. Wendt also, this is in the record, site 940. When he's trying to say, oh yeah, I know we sued him back here in April and then amended in June of 2016, but you know, that shouldn't be held against us because although we sued him and an attorney signed pleadings under Rule 11, you know, we didn't have any evidence, okay? Well, how does he know that unless he's running the show, right? And he is running the show because I just showed it. He's the managing member of the general partner of Powell Pro Steel, and he's the managing member of LLC. So he is controlling both, and Powell Pro LLC is controlling both entities. And then we do have, yes, there's a reported decision where Judge Sparks sat through a long trial, and if you read that, it's an interesting opinion, and he starts it out and he talks about, he gives a cautionary tale of greed to all the parties in that case and anyone reading that case about what happens when people focus on money and not trying to do the right thing. And he does say in there, he says, everyone's using the name Powell Pro and both parties don't really tell me which Powell Pro it is at issue. But he does say that Powell Pro Steel LP was the operational arm of the Powell Pro entities. We asked Magistrate Lane and then Judge Ezra to take judicial notice of that. They did in the opinions. Under Rule 201, Powell Pro could have said, hey, don't do that, here's the evidence. We have nothing to do with them, right? But there's no privity here. Our interests aren't aligned, here's why. They didn't do that. The rule says you can request to be heard on judicial notice, and they never did file a request. Finally, I think it's also collateral estoppel. I mean, that issue was decided. There was a prior lawsuit, and this is in the opinion, so I think they're stopped from saying, no, we're not the operational arm of the Powell Pro entities. Okay, breach of contract, raise judicata. There are a few things that I want to point out just to make sure in case this court is not buying anything that I just said. In the reply, and you never know when someone files a reply, that if you disagree with something, should you file a response or bring it up in argument? So I'm bringing it up in argument. In their reply on appeal, this is in their reply brief at page 8, and then again at page 22. So at page 8, they said, you know, while Powell Pro Steel LP surmised that Plymouth might be breaching the agreements in 2016, Plymouth denied those sales, prompting Powell Pro Steel to abandon that counterclaim. That, and there's no record cite for that in their statement, and that's not true. We told them, you know, you mentioned that email, the April 20 email, where we said, hey, if you don't pay us, we might get back into business. It's not something we want to, but we may be forced to do it. And then we sent them a letter officially terminating. They never called and said, are you making connectors for anybody else? They never asked us. And that underlying, in that Illinois litigation, they never served a discovery request saying, are you making connectors for others? So the statement that we denied making connectors after we terminated is wrong, and there is no evidence of that. And then they repeat that same thing on page 22. The plaintiff, the appellant here, says it should not be lost on the court that Plymouth outright denied selling to others in 2016. That's not true. couple other cleanup points. Down below, we argued to Judge Lane and Judge Ezra, if you don't buy any of this, well, they were judicially dissolved. Okay, Pile Pro LLC, that's the party that we had the agreement with, was judicially dissolved in September of 2018 and then filed bankruptcy in March of 2019. So we said, even if it's not barred by res judicata, not barred by limitations, the agreement itself says it terminates upon the cessation of Pile Pro LLC doing business or Pile Pro LLC filing for bankruptcy without a reorganization. And we said, therefore, even if you don't buy anything, what we said, the cutoff date should be September 2018 when they were judicially dissolved. And that opinion is in the judge's records. It's in the judge's opinion and it's in the record. And then we also said, if for some reason the judicial dissolution doesn't terminate the agreement, the bankruptcy should. Pile Pro responded to our summary judgment and said, we concede the bankruptcy stops. That's the end of the agreement. They did not respond to the judicial resolution argument that we made. And Magistrate Lane caught on that. And he said, you know, should, and so this is in Magistrate Lane's opinion, which was adopted in its entirety by the District Court Judge Ezra. Magistrate Lane said, this is record site 977 through 978. Should any of Sheet Pile's claims survive summary judgment, Plymouth argues that it cannot be liable for sales of exclusivity products to third parties after Pile Pro filed for bankruptcy or was judicially dissolved. He talks about how they agree that bankruptcy terminated it. And then Judge Lane says, but Sheet Pile did not respond to Plymouth's argument that Plymouth cannot be liable for sales after the September 2018 judicial dissolution. It therefore waived that argument. And so that then went to Judge Ezra. He adopted the opinion, and that is not up on appeal now. They haven't said, there was a note in the reply brief, footnote 6 on page 7 in their reply brief, that judicial I'm out of time. All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Carlisle. We appreciate it. Mr. Terrazas, you're back with 3 minutes.
Not much time. I want to address just a few points in some of the questions that were asked. Judge Ramirez, one of your questions in terms of that Skyline litigation with Plymouth, that was an anti-competition suit. So when we talk about the indemnification under the 2011 agreement was for patent infringement. It was something that was separate there. And Plymouth did settle with Skyline in that suit in a confidential settlement agreement that wouldn't release any details to anyone. There is no way for Pile Pro to know at that time that Plymouth was deciding to re-enter the market to sell any products whatsoever. So you can't say that because it was an anti-competition suit that somehow because there's a settlement that Papa would have any idea that there was any sales that were going on. And to be very clear, in April of 2016, when the counterclaims were filed, there were no sales that were done by Plymouth. It had not breached the exclusivity agreement at that time. And there was no way for Papa to know. It did ask in 2015 and got a fiery email back that said, how could you possibly think that we're doing this? We're not entering the market. We have no intent to enter the market whatsoever. We're not gonna sell products for anyone. So there's no way for Pile Pro to have known during that time of what's going on. I do wanna point out in terms of, again, in the summary judgment briefing, and this is on record 520 to 521, we're talking about the privity argument and what arguments were made by Plymouth. The only argument was made was that the parties to the counterclaim are effectively identical to the parties to the instant action as Sheet Pile acquired all of Pile Pro in bankruptcy, including the rights to any legal claims. And it says as Pile Pro's assignee, Sheet Pile stands in Pile Pro LLC's shoes. And then it talked about in the counterclaim that somehow Pile Pro Steel LP, that it was a party to the agreement and didn't take any efforts to distinguish itself from Pile Pro LLC. That is the sum total of what was argued in the summary judgment as to privity. There was never a request in that motion to take judicial notice of another case that PowPro was somehow, or PowPro Steel was somehow the operational arm of PowPro. And so that wasn't addressed until we got to the district court's opinion, and that was improper under Fifth Circuit law. And also, the last point I'll make is that being a managing member of an LLC does not establish privity. Privity is between entities, not between people. You can have a relationship of the same manager among multiple different entities, and that does not establish that there is privity between the entities itself, as long as they're obeying their corporate formalities. And there's no evidence here that PowPro Steel and PowPro were not obeying their corporate formalities.
One quick limitations question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you aware of any Texas authority? Can you point to any Texas case that has applied the discovery rule to a breach of contract claim?
No, Your Honor, I don't know of any that have applied it. The ViaNet case from the Texas Supreme Court has said it doesn't foreclose it.
Right.
And Your Honor, I know I'm out of time, if I may, just for 15 sure. more seconds. Again, I think that the key here is the very uniqueness of this contract. This is a contract where you would not know that there is a breach until it actually occurred and somehow you got notice of it. It's not something where you'd be expected, especially when Plymouth said that it's not going to sell any products, that you wouldn't expect that there would have to be products that were sold such that you would expect that there could be a breach at any point. And it went for over a year.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it. Thank you both. The case is submitted.
Thank you.